gmail.com.
Welcome to the Alti Interview Innovation Channel, where we explore the ideas and innovations shaping tomorrow's economy. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Hermann Ludwig Möller, director at the European Space Policy Institute in Vienna. What makes today's conversation particularly timely is the journey behind it. Ludwig and I first met just 4 weeks ago at the World Economic Forum in Davos, where geopolitics, technology, and capital markets intersect at the highest level. Just last week, he was at the Munich Security Conference, right at the center of the global strategic dialogue. And today he joins us here in our studio to connect the dots between space policy, security, innovation, and the future of Europe. Ludwig, wonderful to have you with us. How are you doing?
Great, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
It's a real pleasure to have you with us today. For our listeners who may not yet be familiar with your work, could you please tell us a bit about your role at the European Space Policy Institute?
Well, I think most importantly when you say ESP, European Space Policy Institute, is to keep in mind it's an independent institution. It's a quasi-international structure under Austrian law. In fact, it's a bit similar to the World Economic Forum in that sense. Our members, however, they are pretty much the space agencies of Europe, also the European Space Agency, also the European Commission. We have also some industrial members. We give independent advice, recommendations to policymakers and people that may decide on space programs. Ultimately, our reach is really to work into the policy sphere, so to help shaping policies driven also by space and space policy.
If you had to summarize Europe's current position in the global space landscape in just a few sentences, how would you characterize it?
Europe's role in space is defined by a focus on what you may call space applications. So this is most famously Earth observation with Copernicus, driven by climate also policies at the time that were climate-centric, where today, I can anticipate, as you may know, they are moving closer to security and defense. So this is where, in terms of space applications, we are strong. Galileo for navigation is another example, where Europe, compared to the US, but also China in particular, is not at the same level, is certainly security and defense. There is a difference in terms of invest factor of 15 compared to the US, as an example. It's a quite substantial. We do not have a tradition in this in Europe, whereas we are waking up to it now. And then when it comes to the moon, it comes to space exploration, and it's between China and the US today, we are still a junior partner. So when you want to position Europe compared to the space powers, I think we are okay, and in some cases world leading in Earth observation navigation. We are catching up, although it's quite a significant catching up to be done, but in security and defense. And we try to figure out how we develop maybe an own posture when it comes to the moon.
You recently attended the launch of Ariane 6. Could you describe the significance of this mission and why it matters for Europe?
In fact, yeah. So between Davos and Munich, there was a little rocket going up, and it was in fact the biggest and the strongest launch ever done from European soil and by Ariane. So it was a new configuration with four boosters. It had 32 satellites on board, Amazon, LEO, and it worked flawlessly. So this is, I think, an important element. We should never take it for granted that that size of rocket and machinery and engineering complexity just works. And you see it with Starlink, Starship, I should say, that admittedly is the next step in terms of size of the rocket. But there is a path to get these things into smooth operations, and I think this is what we have witnessed. This is the rocket side of the story. If you look at the payload side, equally interesting, I would argue, this is an internet constellation. So it's not a European constellation. So it is actually international market, global market, and US driven. And the one thing that I would have liked to see in Kourou for the launch is not only the successful rocket, but also European passenger and maybe a deployment of what eventually might be a European constellation.
You mentioned that the payload included Amazon satellite in low Earth orbit. For listeners less familiar with the terminology, what exactly is meant by LEO, L-E-O, and how does it differ from other orbital regimes?
Yes, LEO is an abbreviation. It stands for low Earth orbit. And this is an orbit. It's a bit higher typically as the space station, which is around 400 kilometers. Here we're talking about in the range of 700 kilometers, a bit lower, a bit above. But primarily in contrast to what historically has been the focus of space in geostationary orbit, GEO, which is 36,000 kilometers off above Earth, which has the specificity that the satellite at that stage turns at the same speed as Earth. So it is stationary with respect to where it stands above the planet. And LEO satellites, they circle the planet. Every 90 minutes, roughly, they do one round. So you need to have many of them. This is why we talk about constellations. And ideally, there's always a satellite or two or three above you in Frankfurt or Vienna that allow you to do what you want to do with the system.
Satellite technology has been around for decades, yet its strategic importance seems to be accelerating. In your view, what is fundamentally changing in this sector right now?
Well, that's a big question. I think the most important, we've been doing satellites, and we do Earth observation satellites for Copernicus or navigation satellites for Galileo and many other things since a long, long time and successfully. What is changing is really, I like to call it the Model T. So this is about mass production. This is about cutting cost. This is about being able to ship, tens and dozens and more of satellites every week. We see this happening in the US. We see the beginning of this in Europe. The technology is there. You also see now some space industries merging with other industries, like in defense, where certain skill set to scale up, also maybe some skill set from the automotive industry, where this is commonplace. Mass production. So this is a key element. We've seen this in launchers, what Elon Musk is doing with his rocket, Falcon 9 in particular. It's a high pace of launch, and that has changed the cost of getting satellites into orbits, which is the necessary condition. And now what we see is the same happening on what you actually put in the rocket.
Let's consider a thought experiment. If all satellites were suddenly switched off, what would the immediate impact on our societies and economies look like?
It would probably be even more significant than we imagine. There is a lot of talk about it. What would be a day without satellite, right? I think it's not far from if I unplug your electricity and Frankfurt goes dark. We are so much used, as one example, to navigating in our cars and navigation systems, and they come from satellites. If you walk and you try to find your restaurant, you Google Maps, and you try to locate where you are yourself, I think you are permanently dependent on this, and we take it for granted. We don't have any car atlas anymore in our cars to drive around, and nobody would buy a car without a navigation system, so there is a strong dependency. It's also in other things that are more hidden, like the timing synchronization on your ATM machine when you withdraw money between your bank and the machine. There is a complexity in this, and there are many domains. Weather forecast on the news, you see the patterns of clouds coming across the Atlantic, whether you have snow for your ski holidays, and all of this would be disconnected. I could extend this, and it has been very prominent in a different domain in Ukraine, when in fact there was a big discussion on Elon Musk and capability provided to the troops on the ground to have the intelligence to support the operations. In fact, the first thing Russia did when the night at 4 o'clock in the morning when they invaded Ukraine, they took out a commercial communication satellite that were used by the Ukrainian troops. So you see there is a strong, strong dependency. Maybe to illustrate this further, and we may come to it, the duality that it's not only the one or the other, it's not a civilian or military question. When they did this on this commercial satellite, and they did it with a military objective, that very same satellite happened to be used for wind farms in northern Germany. I think 5,000 wind turbines. They have a remote monitoring by satellite. They are over big geographical regions, easy for satellites to connect to, and they basically were disconnected. So it's a collateral damage. The target was military, and the damage was also civilian.
From a financial and infrastructure perspective, would you say that space today should be understood as critical infrastructure, or perhaps even as a new form of economic territory?
Excellent point. And in fact, it is something that in the discussion, in particular in Davos, emerged. Sometimes it's good to have the discussions with people that are not necessarily space focused and come from the space bubble, as you may call it sometimes. There was a comparison being made that space, ultimately, you could consider as a piece of real estate. This is a plot of land that you want to acquire to develop a business. And it is not always evident how this business will develop. I could take California at the time when the West was conquered, a time of Wild West. In fact, sometimes space today is compared to the Wild West. And you had the Klondike and the gold rush as one element. But today, California is one of the richest regions on the planet. And a comparison I dare to make in Davos was actually, let us make sure, it may sound bizarre, but let us make sure that the moon is not the next Greenland. The point I'm trying to make here, this is about really geographies and territories that have an economic dimension, a geopolitical dimension, or a mix of the two, which in fact you see today.
Roughly speaking, how many operational satellites are currently in orbit, and how do you expect that number to evolve over the next coming years?
I think I should have a count in my office to make sure I give you a good answer. But we are above 10,000. Yeah, it's more than 10,000. I don't want to give a precise number because I probably would be wrong. It changes by the day. Like you take Amazon Leo as an example, they are going to deploy in the thousands, and I think they have now reached a few hundred. Yeah. So this is really scaling up quickly. What is interesting to answer that question in a bigger scope, there has just been a filing, in fact, a request by Elon Musk for a network which would be a mesh of data centers. So what we used on the ground, data centers for artificial intelligence, and the filing is for 1 million satellites. If you take all requests right now that are somewhere in the books, it doesn't mean that they will happen. Yeah, this is a Darwinistic and opportunistic system in a way, so you can certainly expect some winners and losers. But 1.7 million is the aggregate of what is being in some plans and filings. I do not think that we will have anything like this in the next future, and maybe not tomorrow and after tomorrow, but this is the trend. And it gives you an idea that what we see now, when we are excited, when it's about in the thousands or in the 10,000s, I mean, this order of magnitude will just really continue to increase, and not linearly.
Given the rapid increase in satellite deployments, how can we ensure that space remains a secure, sustainable, and properly governed domain?
That is a very justified and very important point. And maybe two answers to this. On one side, there are efforts to regulate, which means like by a legislator, which can be on international scale. It can be conditions a state puts on the satellites that it allows to be launched. And I think this is something we see happening, but it is certainly not at the pace of what we see in terms of deployment in space. So this in itself cannot be the only answer. Now, if you invest tens of billions and maybe more as an entrepreneur in the systems that we see now being developed and deployed, you could argue there is also a self-interest on that business model to preserve your infrastructure. So there will be ways to operate these systems. There will be ways to look into how do we replace and deorbit these systems. I would put this under the heading of best practice. And I think what you will see is the mix between regulatory efforts and what people will do with the system as they deploy it. Now, are we in the right balance between the two? This is a tricky question, and you could argue that sometimes businesses go above the speed limit. And so there is certainly an increasing risk, and I think there is a true concern that we need to make sure that this is within reason. And the best answer to this, if you ask me, is to be part of that exercise. So if I compare this to traffic rules on the motorway or in your city, you better have your own cars in that traffic to be able to discuss who stops at a red light and that there are red lights. And this is something that we should also work on. So it's not only what Europe does traditionally when we have a regulatory drive, and we always have that, maybe sometimes over-regulating, but we also need to be part of the game.
Turning to the investment dimension, beyond high-profile entrepreneurs such as Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, are institutional investors already meaningfully participating in the space economy?
Well, first, it may sound bizarre because now it takes all the headlines, the entrepreneurship and private money. In the cases you mentioned, they in fact, this is what they are. But 85% of space budgets globally are still public funded. Also in the case, 85% is public by governments, yes. Traditionally, and we all know it, this is in the US, this is NASA, and it has been equally the Pentagon. The Pentagon by now has, in fact, overtaken the NASA budget. But Elon Musk himself, in order to build his rocket, what did he build the rocket on? It was about 4 billion contracts that he got through NASA to bring cargo to the space station. And now he's also shipping astronauts to the station, including just now a French European astronaut. And from this, he basically was able to develop his own business model that then he commercialized, and which today is an important return on invest. And what he does, and it may be your next question, how this goes with where you invest and where you can earn your revenues. He now is populating this. He has a version that is maybe more defense version of Starlink. And he will probably put sensors and other payloads on what used to be a communications constellation. And those are services he can also sell back to government. So it's a nice circle of finance where you start with public funds, you have an entrepreneur to develop a business, and then he takes the capability of the business to go back to the government to sell into government services.
In that context, could space, particularly orbital assets, eventually become an attractive long-term allocation for institutional investors, such as pension funds or insurance companies? At present, it seems that only government funds financed by taxpayers' money are involved.
Yes. It's a very good distinction you made, which sometimes we don't make enough when I just said public and you said government. The discussion in Davos, in fact, when we talked about real estate, one question we ask ourselves, could space be of interest for pension funds? Now, space at first sight sounds, and it is a deep tech business. It's a risky business. There are many question marks attached to it. There are not the evident business cases all over. Connectivity certainly is one from which you can build further. But if you really can understand the narrative of real estate and long-term investment and what pension funds would typically do to invest into bricks, something that remains to be there, you could argue, why would you not invest in orbits why would you not invest in a piece of the moon? Because there is going to be, I mean, those things are going to be there. They remain. And there will be a development in this. And you could argue for somebody who wants to have a long-term perspective, there in fact is a narrative, which in many cases is not the narrative you see today when it's about the immediate return on invest.
Are rocket launches and space missions insurable today? And how does the insurance market assess the associated risks?
Oh, yes, I'm sure there are launches that are being insured. It is always a trade-off. It depends on what it is. If you have scientific missions, that is one story. In many cases, the programs will not be able to afford the launch if there is a clear business case attached to it. And then it depends on the reliability of the launcher, for instance. There's certainly an insurance in it. It's an argument for a rocket like Ariane, for instance, which has a high reliability. So that will obviously also dimension the price you pay for the insurance. This model exists, yes.
Given the sophisticated engineering behind modern launch systems, how is reliability evaluated, particularly for new launch vehicles such as Ariane 6? Are the risks well known?
Well, they know, for sure. So there is a probability. There certainly is an analysis. In fact, these systems are designed for a certain reliability by design. And if you look at the statistics, take Ariane 5 over its lifetime, it had an extremely high reliability. There was a problem with the very first launch, which went wrong, which happened recently also to the Japanese on their heavy launcher. And it was a true question mark on the first launch of Ariane 6, because the probability of a very first launch to succeed is around 50%. Now, on Ariane, what we've seen is pretty much a flawless ramp up from the first launch.
As an independent policy advisor, how receptive are European policymakers to ESPE's recommendations? Are you satisfied with the current strategic direction?
We are in a time which is primarily driven by external disruption. And I would argue, and it's probably not a surprise, the biggest disruption in very recent time was the Munich Security Conference last year by the Vice President of the US that really triggered what we have seen since in stepping up on Europe taking care of its own security and defense. And that also translated in that particular case very quickly in governmental investments in that case, 35 billion by the defense ministry in Germany, announced this summer in Berlin. What happens then is quite an interesting mechanism. Investors and private investors here, they can see that there is an anchor customership or there is a governmental commitment to the space to come. That can be the rockets, that can be also development of satellites in mass production. And you see this in the stock market value of some of the companies that went up significantly. Also some defense companies are teaming up with space companies. You see it also take some of the launchers that raise considerable amounts of money all of a sudden, because there is a clear understanding that these rockets, once they fly, will be used. So people are ready to take a certain risk, but they bet on the future. And in that particular case, this is typically enabled by the anchor customer investment and commitment on the governmental side, similar to what Elon Musk did with NASA for the space station.
Looking ahead, what major structural developments do you anticipate in the space industry over the next months and probably, if you can make a forecast, years?
Well, I think we will have two movements. One, what I would call a horizontal integration. There is a discussion of some big satellite manufacturers to join and to maybe be more cost effective. We've seen this in other industries, and I always say this is in itself not, shouldn't be a surprise. I think it's probably a normal evolution. But what is maybe more interesting is that if you look at Elon Musk and others, They are what we call vertically integrated. So they build, they own the launch pad, they own the rocket, they own what they put in the rocket, they operate the constellation, and they sell the service. You can buy a Starlink terminal for your home, and you can do the same very soon with Amazon. So you have the full value chain in one hand. In Europe, you have an industry segmentation where you have operators like Eutelsat. You have big, large-scale integrators, as we call them. You have supply chains, and you have an emerging launcher segment. Now, what you see in some cases now is that there is a first sign of some verticalization in these. There was just an announcement today from a company in Berlin doing things like this. So they basically do a one-stop shop, and they ensure the launch, they cooperate with a satellite manufacturer, they deploy, and then they operate. And I think this is a key element, because what it does, it links the service market to the chain you need to enable the service. It is not the individual elements that you build, it is really what you sell to a customer. The customer can be governmental or public, it can be governmental or institutional, and it can be also yourself on your phone.
Let's take the view now from an investment perspective. Do vertically integrated space companies, those controlling launch, satellite manufacturing, operations and services, have a structural advantage?
I would say so yes. What you see now is also that some of the mobile phone operators, they wake up to space. Today you can, and you will, in fact, Elon Musk just spent $17 billion on frequencies that allow you to do direct-to-device communication to your handheld, to your mobile, without changing the handheld. And this is what I call hyperscaling. This is a bit what we saw in the 90s, maybe in Germany, when everybody had his Astra antenna on the house. This is millions of customers for TV broadcasting. I think what we will probably see is this will reach you also on the devices you have today. It is typically a 30-year lag between what's happened on the ground and what happens in space, because it's more complex and challenging to do it in space. But to answer your question, yes, I certainly would look into who is linked to the service segment. And ideally, who is it who maybe connects to space, who already has the customer base?
Does the increasing vertical integration we observe raise concerns about market concentration and strategic dependency?
Well, I don't think you can really stop this train. I think you see this elsewhere. You would probably not argue who owns the towers of your mobile network, who owns the fiber optic cables in the oceans. And I mean, this is also a chain. I mean, your phone, if you talk to me on between mobile phones, there's a lot between your phone and my phone, which is not the phone. And certainly there is a certain degree of integration of this, at least a business relationship between them. I think the strength is to, in particular today, when it's about digital sovereignty, we didn't touch upon this, you have an interest to also have control of the infrastructures that you are using. And so it's not just the terminal equipment, it's also what you are using. So a tendency to go vertical and to control what is called the supply chain is really something that with security concerns today, with what we already see happening, interference from Russia and others, I think this is something that will be increasingly important. And again, not only for military users, also for us. And maybe you don't want your data and what we talk about in some cases be stored and administered somewhere else.
Okay, in that context, what role should regulation play, particularly with regard to digital sovereignty and control over critical infrastructure?
It depends again what we exactly mean with regulation. I think you certainly have an interest to make sure that, talking about space, that also in the future the space will be there to be used. Yeah. So the traffic routes is part of what I said before. That could, for instance, mean if you allow some foreign satellite operator to connect to your mobile phone network, that he has to comply with certain rules of the road. Yeah, and I think we will see this happening over time. I think those things can become criteria for allowing market access. So there are mechanisms that will emerge. Now, I would not think this is about, if that was the question, of avoiding monopolies of vertical integration. I think it is more about making sure that that the chain functions and maybe is also where you can sovereign.
If you could formulate a concise policy wish list for European decision makers, what would be your top priorities?
Well, first, to make sure that the wish list actually reaches the politician, which is a challenge in itself. So space on the radar of politicians is very young. It's maybe as young as 2 years old. I think this is probably really came on the policy agenda when people realized that Elon Musk could switch off the satellites over Ukraine. I think that was an enormous impulse when policymakers understood not only the dependency with respect to entrepreneurs, but also how much space was already had become already relevant. So this is happening, but it is still something in the making. So first thing, and this is what we do in the Institute, make sure the recommendations, wish list, actually reach the audience. That's the first challenge. Then what is on that wish list? In most simple terms, I think we need to appreciate that space is really three things. Traditionally, and we all know this, it's used to be Apollo and the moon and space exploration, and astronauts still are an attractive element. Next to it, and this is recent, we have discovered that space is relevant for security and defense. And historically, those are the two legs from which space really originate in the States, NASA and Pentagon, if you want. And then there is a third one, which is more recent, and this is, I call this the digital. So to be aware that space is part of our digital economy, digital society. It's a key enabling element of whatever we do, like the internet 30 years ago. That's the best comparison. And on the wish list, on the recommendations, all three should appear together with a message that you cannot disassociate them. And to be concrete, you may have lots of development out of a commercial segment of a hyperscaled digital economy that can be adopted as technology and dual use also on the security side. And this is, for instance, what you see right now in the States, where the Pentagon and the Space Force, they both have issued strategies to integrate commercial solutions into their portfolio. So the wish list is, first of all, get the wish list on the table of the ministers and head of governments. And second, really be aware to act on all three elements, the moon, security and defense, and digital.
Which European countries are currently showing the strongest political and industrial momentum in space, and how do you see that balance evolving?
Very good question. Historically, it has been France, and it's again planned for this summer. Macron will call a space summit in Paris to bring together the different actors also internationally. France has also a very strong space industry. Maybe about one third of European space industry is in France. But the real game change is right now on Germany, where Germany had the highest subscription at the ESA Ministerial, which is a funding round every 3 years of the European Space Agency, with record results last November. So Germany came in first. And next to what they put on the table through the ESA mechanism, there is this $35 billion invest for the next 5 years coming from the defense ministry. And that will change the German posture. It will change the growth of the German industrial ecosystem. It will, in fact, be a challenge. And I think it will also shift the powers on who is really with the leaders in space, to something that certainly should work between France and Germany, which sometimes is a challenge, as we see right now on military jets. But this, I think, is the true shift that we see, where Germany is about to become the leading space nation in Europe.
Thank you. Space is no longer a distant frontier. It is a critical infrastructure. It powers our navigation, our communication, our security, and increasingly our economies. Europe has strengths, but it also faces strategic choices. How to secure sovereignty, how to regulate responsibly, and how to position itself in a rapidly scaling global space economy. For policymakers, space is a matter of our future and security. For investors, it could become the next long-term infrastructure project. Hermann Ludwig Möller from the European Space Policy Institute, a think tank for decision makers. Thank you for your insights.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Take care.
LTE.com, the online portal for institutional investors in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. LTE.com.